from KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm John Sepulveda. We begin in Washington, D.C. That's where Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco is calling for the attorney general's resignation. Earlier this year, Jeff Sessions was asked under oath during his Senate confirmation hearing whether the Trump campaign had contact with Russian operatives. This is what he said.
I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
You are likely to hear that exchange a lot more in the near future. As the Washington Post broke the story, that statement is not true. NPR and others are also reporting that Sessions met with Russian officials at least twice. Sessions now says he didn't meet with Russians on behalf of the Trump campaign. Pelosi says that Sessions, quote, lied under oath and is, quote, not fit to serve as the top law enforcement officer of our country. Meanwhile, federal immigration authorities are changing the screening process for some people applying for asylum. KQED's Zadie Stavely reports on new guidelines that went into effect Monday.
When a person who is facing deportation tells an immigration agent they're afraid of returning to their country, an asylum officer has to interview them to determine if they might be able to win asylum. It's called a reasonable or credible fear interview. If they pass, they get to argue their case before a judge. But immigration lawyers say that new training guidelines released by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services on how to conduct asylum interviews raise the bar to even get in front of a judge. Laura Polstein is an attorney with Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland. She says one of the changes directs asylum officers to give more weight to the statements people make when they are first arrested. At that point, she says, they may not disclose all the reasons they fear returning to their country.
Because maybe they're really dehydrated, really exhausted, in a detention center in front of a bunch of other people. That inconsistency of not having revealed the past harm at that point could be held against them.
A spokeswoman for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services did not provide comment and pointed instead to a recent Homeland Security memo clarifying President Trump's immigration policies. For the California Report, I'm Zadie Stavely.
Let's move now to Oakland, where Yemeni Americans with businesses are concerned about efforts to step up deportations of undocumented immigrants, not just because they could lose neighbors, but also because they could lose business. KQED's Farida Javalo Romero reports.
Mujib Alamari works the register and bags groceries at his store in Oakland's heavily Latino Fruitvale neighborhood.
Muchas gracias.
Like other Yemeni American shop owners in the area, he disagrees with President Trump's recent orders on immigration. And he tells me this in Spanish, a language he speaks more than English. There's two problems, he says. A new travel ban would make it harder for his wife and children who live in Yemen to move here. And stepped up deportations of undocumented immigrants could hurt long-term customers he cares about. Even though Alamari is a U.S. citizen, he fears traveling to Yemen now could cause him problems. Down the street, another store owner, Abdul Talib, who also has a U.S. passport, is canceling his vacation plans to Mexico. Why? He says flying with a Middle Eastern name was already a headache under the Obama administration.
So now I imagine with this administration, it's going to be even harder.
Talib was relieved when the courts intervened with President Trump's original travel ban, targeting citizens from Yemen and other Muslim-majority countries. But others say the courts should stay out of it. Dan Stein is from the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a nonprofit that seeks to reduce immigration.
The president has the responsibility of ensuring that people coming into this country as visitors, as refugees, as immigrants, that they are not people being sent as operatives who would engage in terrorism.
Regardless of how the new travel ban affects people from Muslim countries, Talib says he worries more about the Latino community around him. At his store, he's organizing an event to inform undocumented immigrants about their rights. For the California Report, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
We're going to move on now to the University of California and take a look at sexual harassment and violence investigations throughout the system. This week, after a public records request by KQED and other media outlets, UC released details of 113 cases at its 10 campuses, where investigations found evidence of misconduct. These cases happened between January of 2013 and April of 2016. KQED's senior editor for California Politics and Government, Scott Schaefer, reports on what comes next.
The cases detail a range of bad behavior by campus staff and faculty, from inappropriate flirtation and unwanted sexual comments to lewd texts, touching, and other sexual assaults. Well before UC released these documents, University President Janet Napolitano created a new position to implement updated policies against sexual harassment and violence throughout the university system. The person charged with that task is Kathleen Salvati, and she says several changes are already being implemented throughout UC.
One is, I think, the creation of a confidential care advocate on every campus who works exclusively with members of our community who've experienced sexual violence and sexual harassment. So that's very important.
Salvati says the goal is to create policies that are fair, transparent, and consistently implemented.
Obviously, in a perfect world, we do want to eliminate sexual harassment and sexual violence. If we can't get that, we want to make sure people do understand their right to report and feel confident that we will appropriately respond.
UC Berkeley found itself facing unwelcome scrutiny over sexual harassment cases within the last 2 years. The cases released this week mostly involve the other nine UC campuses. For the California Report, I'm Scott Schaefer.
There is a new listing on the New York Stock Exchange this morning, Snap Incorporated, owner of Snapchat. The Venice-based messaging app priced its IPO at $17 per share, the largest debut since Alibaba in 2014. To talk about what this means for Snapchat and the nascent Silicon Beach, we're joined by Quina Kim, senior editor of KQED's Silicon Valley Desk. Good morning, Quina.
Thanks for having me.
In the run-up to the IPO offering, there's been a lot of focus on Snapchat's privacy relative to other social media platforms. How might this impact future business?
That's a good question. Obviously, Google and Facebook have made a lot of money by mining our data and being able to sort of personalize our advertising
to us.
Snap took a totally different point of view. As you know, their first product was disappearing pictures, right? They didn't keep that data, or purportedly they didn't. They've been able to create other kinds of products. The question is, how far can that go when all your competitors are offering advertisers, hey, we can specialize it to John Sepulveda because we know exactly what he wants to do. Another thing that's been really coming up is augmented reality. So what augmented reality is, it overlays sort of a filter on our real world. So point your photo to like a building and maybe, you know, a little Taco Bell thing pops up and says, hey, there's a Taco Bell in here.
So that's really interesting. So Facebook and Google and other companies are really looking at figuring out what we like and what we don't like and tailoring the ads to us. But Snapchat is actually looking at essentially incorporating the ads in the way we look at the world.
I guess that's a good way to put it.
Now, Snapchat really stands apart from other Silicon Valley companies in the fact that it's not actually in Silicon Valley. It's in Los Angeles. Are there ways that the company has adopted some Hollywood attributes?
Really early on, compared to those companies, they're starting to acquire sort of this video that's made for their platform. Mm. And I'm sure you know this, a lot of millennials aren't tuning into the regular TVs, and that's becoming a long-term problem for a lot of entertainment companies. And so I think they're trying to position themselves as, hey, they're on our platform, and why don't you make, quote, TV content for Snap? And that's definitely the entertainment angle right there.
Finally, for Los Angeles, Los Angeles has long looked to become Silicon Beach, is the term often used. Does this show that the city has finally arrived in the digital entrepreneurial space?
I think it does, in that, you know, in terms of just the symbolicness of it, it's one of the big sexy companies, tech companies. But there's another effect. As you know, there's going to be a lot of millionaires that are going to come out of this IPO. And we often think about it like lay people as in, like, you know, lots of cars and houses being bought. Mm. But this IPO dynamic is really sort of important to the way Silicon Valley develops. And I spoke to a guy named Ophir Tanz. He's the founder of Gum Gum. It's a tech company headquartered in Santa Monica. And this is how he explains it.
And what those millionaires then do is they turn around and start investing back into the ecosystems. Those individuals also start their own companies.
So you've heard of the PayPal mafia? That's sort of the idea there. The founders of PayPal, Reid Hoffman, went on to go and found LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk went on to create Tesla and SpaceX. Peter Thiel went on to go invest in Facebook. So it's this money that's being sort of invested back into the tech community there. It just allows them to grow a lot faster.
The Snapchat Mafia. I'm looking forward to reading that story. Probably be written by Queena Kim, who joined us in studio. Thanks, Queena.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the California Report comes from Personal Capital, the website that shows all financial accounts in one place and helps plan for retirement. PersonalCapital.com. Barracuda Networks, security, archiving, and backup solutions for physical networks and public cloud services such as Microsoft Azure and Office 365. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
And that's the California Report for Thursday, March 2nd, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm John Sepulveda. Have a great day.